There's a beautiful story I wanted to relate. There's a quartet called the Kolish Quartet. Does anybody know it? It's a Russian quartet. They have the unique distinction of being the only quartet that plays all of their pieces from memory. And some of their work is, they're playing incredibly complex classical pieces, and it's extraordinary when you actually consider what they're actually accomplishing. And Eugene Lerner, who was the first violinist, he tells this story of their playing an extraordinarily difficult piece, and he's just about to go into a solo, a violin solo, and he for the first time ever, he completely blacks out of what he's supposed to play. And, you know, the embarrassment is, like, intense. They're, like, the world's greatest quartet, and he's, you know, he's one of the greatest violinists, and he's just blacked out. And at the exact microsecond, the exact second that he's supposed to start his solo, the second violinist, a guy named Felix Kerner, comes in and plays the entire solo. It's so flawless that the other two instrumentalists who have their eyes closed don't notice that anything happened. That's amazing. So Eugene Lerner's freaking out, you know. So he goes to, and he starts playing the second violinist part. He's like, what the hell just happened, you know? How did this happen? So they play the whole performance. And then afterwards, he goes up to Felix and he says, what happened? You know, like, how did you know to come in? And this is what Felix says. He says, I could see that your finger was poised over the wrong string, so I knew you must have blanked out on what came next.
Wow.
Like, that's extraordinary, you know? When I read that, I just started weeping, right? Like, why is that a touching story? Why is attentiveness touching? You know, why is attentiveness, why is there a beauty in attentiveness? You know, if I had told you a story about how pleasurable I felt watching TV last night, you know, or how pleasurable I felt being, you know, dull, or, you know, it wouldn't, there's nothing that would move your heart about that. There's something, we're all tied into this. The way I think about it is we all have like some like little bell in our hearts that starts to resonate. It's like E.T.'s finger, right? You remember? Like, what is it like when he, is it when the alien, yeah, but when they come close, like the finger lights up, you know? And it's like we have some, there's some kind of resonance in us that vibrates when we touch on something that is the direction we should be going, you see? And when I hear a story like that level of attentiveness, it's like there's something in me that is, and I think for you all too, that it's so attractive. And especially to have that kind of attentiveness directed towards you. I was thinking of Ram Dass told a story about watching an Ayurvedic doctor feel the pulse of a patient. You know, you use three fingers, and if you've ever seen it happen, they'll just stand next to the patient and just get really quiet and start to notice what's happening in the pulse. And there's an attentiveness with these three fingers that's mind-blowing. They can tell you if you have a problem in your kidney or if it's a gallbladder thing, based on the sensitivity of their fingers. And Ram Dass said, I watched this patient and this doctor, and it made me long to be in that patient's position, just to have somebody that attentive with me. One of the things that happens in retreat is you regret things, like deep, deep, deep regret. I went in retreat feeling like I had a pretty clean slate, you know? And about, I don't know, 3 months into it, it gets overwhelming. Like, I'll be in meditation and suddenly I remember that I called that girl in third grade fat, you know? And it was, you know, and I'm like, the weight of it is unbelievable. I can remember exactly where I was standing in the hallway. I can remember what direction I was facing. I can remember other kids. And before retreat, I had didn't know that existed in my memory banks, you know? And as the pratyahara, as the sense withdrawal happens, everything starts coming up. And it's so painful. It's like, you're like, why did I call her fat, you know? And And then I think about it, it was because I was this little fat kid, and I felt like uncomfortable with it, and so I was projecting that, and so you can see all the dynamics, but it's so painful. I was reading this morning a commencement address by George Saunders, who's an author. I forget what college he gave it at, and he said this, which struck me as so true. He said, "What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness." And that's what it really, and what I'm talking about was not a failure of kindness. It was an active unkindness, right? But he's talking more subtly. He's saying a failure of kindness. And then he says this, which is beautiful. He says, "Those moments when another human being was there in front of me suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, and mildly." Right? I mean, nobody would fault somebody for that. I mean, nobody would fault somebody for responding sensibly, reservedly, and mildly towards another suffering. But I can tell you, as an absolute fact, that there will come a time, and it might be at the moment of death, or it might be in a long retreat, where every one of those reserved, mild, sensible failures of kindness will just, they'll burden you, you know? And what I realized for me is that I have been burdened by that little girl for all of these years. It's like existed in my psychic body, even though I've been unaware of it. And it's been a weight that's been living in me. The contrast of that is, in kindergarten, we had to choose cubby buddies. I don't know if you ever had cubby buddies, but you know, you share your cubby with this. And I saw this little kid that I was worried nobody would be his cubby buddy, you know, because he was slightly unusual. And so I actively sought him out and asked him if he would be my cubby buddy. And in retreat, that whole moment came up. And the look on his face, this tiny, 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 subtle look of relief came into my body at that moment, you know? And it's been living with me all of these years, right? And it's like been feeding me all of these years. And what happened for me in retreat is suddenly human beings were gone from my world. And at first that was a great relief, you know? And then it became a great grief. Like, I realized how incredibly precious human beings were, and I missed human beings like you can't imagine missing human beings, you know? And I started to realize all of those lost opportunities for kindness. And it's like, there's an analogy in Tibetan Buddhism of a jewel island, and they say it's like going onto a jewel island, and then just covered with diamonds and sapphires and things like that. And you get back on your boat and you sail back to your home country and you realize you never even reached down and grabbed one. Like, you know, you just left and you're like, you get back to port and you're like, what was I thinking? Why didn't I just grab, they were free for the taking, you know? Why didn't I just take some jewels and bring them home with me? And that happened for me so strongly in retreat. And the jewels were human beings, you know? And again, I'm not talking altruism. I'm talking about things that would pay off for me, you know, these jewels that would be valuable for me, because that little look of relief on that kid's face in kindergarten was paying off for me in profound ways my whole life. And that little act of cruelty towards that girl has also been depleting me, right? And so it's, for me, it's helpful to think about it that way, because my capacity for altruism is limited. My capacity for self-serving is immense. Right, it's unlimited, but those two connect when you really get down to the base, those two connect perfectly, altruism and self-serving. The Dalai Lama calls it enlightened self-interest, and you really feel that, right? You and all of you can, I'm sure, think of moments where you've been attentive, or where you've had done some kind of act of kindness, and it's just really serving. Let me say one more thing and we'll take a quick stretch break. We were just listening to a beautiful radio program, and this kid told a story of a husband and wife who were wanted a child and couldn't have one. I forget where they lived. Was it in Philly, maybe? anyway, and this is, I think they're in their 50s now or so, but they really wanted a child. This was 10 years ago. And they couldn't have a child, and they saw one night a homeless pregnant woman. And they came home and they talked about it, and they decided to go see if she would, you know, they said, you can't live on the streets, like, just come in and just stay with us and we'll find you a home. After a little while, they said, listen, why don't you just stay here until the baby's born? And they hit it off. They enjoyed each other's company. And so she stayed, and then the baby was born, and it was working out so well that they just decided to make a family out of it. So they became a four-person family, the child, the woman, and the married couple. And they all contributed to the raising of the child. And so the couple was starting to live out their dreams. Like, this is, their dream was coming true. They were having, being able to raise a child. So they said to the mother, they said, we're getting to live out one of our dreams. Do you have any dreams? We'd like to help you live out one, you know? And she said, I have a dream of becoming a nurse. So she went to nursing school, and she graduated, and she got a job as a nurse. And the child, I think the little girl is 10 years old now. And then the wife developed multiple sclerosis, and her body has started to deteriorate. And now she has a nurse living in the home with her, right? So it's like... Just these beautiful ways that when we begin to become attentive to the world, it's almost like the world steps in and just starts going on this upward spiral in these beautiful ways, right? And a lot of that attentiveness, the foundation of it, is developing some kind of daily interior life. So let's take a quick stretch break. And when we come back, just 5 minutes, because we only got about a half hour left. When we come back, I want to talk about some ideas on developing interior life.
So, Will, before you move on,
yeah.
I have to ask you a question about what we just talked about.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of you thinking about that little girl who you called back.
Yeah.
Now, were you able to, like, rise above that? Guilt, and I mean, was that
part of it? Yeah, and it wasn't just that incident. I mean, I could go on and on.
Yeah, of course.
And I won't, because I'm protecting my own.
but also,
no, go ahead.
I was just curious you going through that, was there a point where you could possibly look at that action as being a blessing?
Was I able to move beyond that? And I was, but it took I'd say the first year was predominantly characterized by regret, lots of regret, and I was surprised by that. And I started reading other people that have done long retreats in different traditions, and you see that across the board, that's a common thing that comes up, is deep regret about things. Our prisons, the way our prison system was designed, was originally developed, I believe, by the Amish. But it is a way of, you know, withdrawing and then feeling the regret for things you have done. And it is a natural process that happens. But about the second year, I started to forgive myself, and I started to allow space for myself to screw up. And a lot of that came with animals, actually, because I have a real sensitivity around animals, and I would accidentally hurt animals, you know, just by living in the world, by existing. I mean, with cars, it's easier because we run into birds or hit a dog or something, and the pain of that. But just to be alive is to cause suffering. We had these ants called pogos. There's harvester ants. And they're big ants, and during ant season, they're everywhere. There's 40,000 to a nest, and they're, you know, so that's a lot of ants. And I had a nest right outside my door, and I would step on them, and I would crouch down and accidentally step on them, and I'd see the like suffering that they went through, you know, and it was just like, just the pain of that was overwhelming. I remember one time we had these crickets. They're huge. I call them Rasta crickets because they're the same color as the Jamaican flag. They're red, yellow, green, and black, and they're really colorful, and they're huge. and I accidentally stepped on one, and all of her insides came out the side of her body, and you know, I thought that she would just die right away, so I took her inside to just do hospice, like to let her die quietly and then bring her back out for the ants, because otherwise the ants would quickly like rip her apart. And it took her over 70 hours to die, and that was like bizarre to me, you know, to sit with this creature for 70 hours as she was dying in incredible pain. And I've sat with so many dying animals and insects that you see the pattern happens. There's convulsions for, you know, for the first few hours nonstop, and then it slows down and she would get really quiet, and then she would start convulsing again, you know, and it slowly gets quieter and quieter, and then there's that moment when she's gone. And to live is to cause suffering. You know, there's no way around it. For the amount of suffering we caused on our way over here is, if you really get subtle enough, is overwhelming. Because you think about how, I mean, that was just one cricket. How many crickets did our cars hit on the way here? You see what I mean? So when you get really sensitive, the amount of pain we create in the world is overwhelming, right? So what do? Do you become like a Jain and, you know, you put your masks on? But Joseph Campbell has a kind of funny statement that the definition of a vegetarian is somebody who can't hear a tomato scream. But, you know, just the idea that you just can't, you know, you can't do it by being vegan and vegetarian. You know, you will cause suffering by being alive. And I realize that, you know, I realize that not just with insects, but with human beings. So my way of dealing with it is just simply doing the best I can. And that's all we can do. And try to be attentive to things that are happening. Because the temptation is to not, to block it, to not notice, you know, the suffering that you cause and to put it out of your mind. Like it's not pleasurable to go pick up an insect in that state and to bring it into my bedroom with me, you know? But there is and this is what we were talking about a little bit earlier about things that are hard at first but are fulfilling in the end. There's an immense richness and soulfulness by sitting with an animal that's dying, just by being present with that level of suffering. What's that?
Or a person.
Yeah, a person, of course. And that's, I think, why people that do hospice work are so so oftentimes fed by the work in a way. It brings you into such a state of soulfulness. There's Huso woman, who's the female Zen Buddhist teacher, Joan Halifax. Joan Halifax has something, I think I have it here. Yeah, she says something beautiful, which gets us into our next thing of how does one develop an interior life. She says, she was talking about working with people on death row, and she's worked a lot with dying people in hospice, death row. She goes to, she went to Russia after Chernobyl and dealt with people that were dealing with fallout. And she says something beautiful. She's about developing compassion. She says, any attachment to outcome would distort deeply my own capacity to be fully present to the whole catastrophe. I'll say that again. Any attachment to outcome would distort deeply my own capacity to be fully present to the whole catastrophe. And what we're talking about with attentiveness is to feel the catastrophe. And with that little girl that I called fat, you know, obviously that's been in my body somewhere, and it hasn't come up yet. And probably with certain traumas that we go through in our lives, we repress them to a certain extent. And a lot of what meditation does is it allows you to be fully present to the whole catastrophe. And that catastrophe, a lot came about for me with that cricket, you know, because that was the first one. I ended up having many, many other on break periods sometimes. Anne would come up, and I felt like it was like a triage ward, you know. I'd be like, careful, you know, and I'd write a little note, be careful, there's a dying cicada over there, there's a rehabilitating praying mantis in the kitchen, don't worry if it jumps on you, you know, there's a two-legged spider and I'm feeding him, you know, dead flies that I find in the room, you know, it's just like it's, but there, that, and you know, that's not most people's practice and that's fine. But for me, that was a way of being present with the whole catastrophe. And I found, I mean, I could tell you, and you would probably think I was weirder, but these beautiful stories that happened to me with insects. We had this mantis that was just an incredible story. I had it for about 3 weeks, a dying praying mantis. And he just, it was a female. The females are huge. And she would, you know, wander around my room at night, and then I would put her outside in the day to feed, and you know, how did she feed? You know, she ate other insects. So it's like this, you know, this whole web. And so was I contributing to the death of other insects by saving this one, you know? There was another time where a lizard grabbed a cicada, and if you know, you've heard cicadas scream. There, it's like, it's very loud, right? So I'm like, what's all the commotion? And there's this lizard, and the way a lizard kills a giant insect is they grab it and then they rake its head back and forth across the ground until it dies, and then they bring it into them, you know. But the problem was the lizard was tiny and the cicada was bigger than the lizard. So I'm looking at this scene and I'm like, there's no way that that lizard, even if it unhinged its jaw, it couldn't get the cicada in its mouth. So the question is always for me, and I say this not because I want you to think about next time you hear a cicada scream, but like, how do you deal with this in the human realm too? Is do I get involved or do I not get involved, right? And I was sitting there, I'm like, what to do? I'm like, it's going to be a useless death. I mean, the ants will get the cicada, but the lizard won't, you know? So I decided, and it could be a fault, right? I decided to get involved. So I grabbed the lizard and I pulled the cicada out of the lizard's mouth. You know, you like tap him on the head, drop the cicada, you know, and pull him out. And the wings are torn, so he's never going to fly again. So now it's just a hospice situation. I'm just taking care of him until he dies, right? And it was epic. And then he started getting fungus on him. So, you know, he'd crawl into my fingers and I'd take him into the sink and we'd wash off the fungus. And, you know, it was absurd, right? And it's just going on and on. But the death was extraordinary and it was beautiful. And it was calm, you know. And I hope, like, that I created some tiny little imprint of calmness at the moment of the death for that cicada. And then when he was dead, I brought him back out and the ants dismantled him and brought him back into, you know, into the subterranean world, and the cycle continued. But I've always struggled with that, like where, at what point do you get involved and at what point do you not get involved? And that's why I love that, you know, this the wording, right? Those moments when another human being was there in front of me suffering and I responded sensibly, reservedly, and mildly. Because to take a cicada out of the mouth of a lizard is, first of all, it's not sensible, it's not reserved, and it's not mild, you know? It's just silly and absurd. And for me, it was the right thing to do based on my present capacity for understanding at that moment. And I've made mistakes my whole life, you know? I think we probably all have, but there's something to be said for pushing that boundary a little bit. So how does one develop an interior life? There's three things I want to suggest around that. What's the very first obstacle to meditation?
Not doing it.
Yeah, not doing it. Or, no, the first obstacle.
You.
Oh, yes. Yeah, getting to the cushion, yeah. Traditionally, scripturally, does anybody know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Scripturally, the first obstacle to meditating is not wanting to meditate, which is basically what you all said. And one of the antidotes to that, this is non-scriptural, this is just from my personal experience, is finding the joy, right? And one way I do that is when I sit down every morning, is I just, the first thing I do is try to tune in to the pleasure of sitting. You know, because it's hard to sit down. It's hard to meditate every day. I mean, it's hard. There's a resistance. For me, it's really hard to get on my yoga mat every day, which I do, and I have for years now, but I'm resistant to it every time. I think the worst was 2 hours of fighting against it, you know? I was like, oh, I'll go read the cookbook again, or, you know, like, maybe I'll, you know, go fill up the bird bath, or, you know, and it's just like, you know, finally I just like, all right, I'm just going to stand at the edge of my mat, you know? So I got on the mat, and then I, like, did my whole practice. But so the for my meditation, it's been valuable to the moment I sit down and just identify the joy. Just take a moment. And sometimes it'll just be like, oh, there's a very tiny sense of pleasure, you know, in my neck through sitting straight, you know. I just noticed everybody's got blankets around there. Is it possible to turn it down? Or, yeah.
You're causing suffering for the
bills of yoga always. Yeah. So, and you know, I tend to be so prone to notice the negative, you know, like, and so it's just a beautiful, it's a habit pattern that can be quite beautiful. So just sit down, notice the pleasurable sensations that are coming up. The second one is, which we've already talked about, that my suggestion and what I found helpful for me in terms of developing an interior life is to feel the catastrophe. It's counterintuitive. Those of you that, is anybody in here a kayaker, river kayaker? Yeah. And, you know, it's a river kayaking is counterintuitive. When, you know, when you tip over, you roll with it, right? As opposed to, like, when I first started learning river kayaking, and I'm sure all of us have done this when we first learned, you start to tip and you're like, whoa, you know, or you're like, and that'll just tip you over, you know, also. But if you can roll with it, then you can just easily, quickly roll yourself back up. And there's this counterintuitive quality to it. Another one is with dropbacks. Right, because if you're going into a drop back, right, the drop back is you stand here and you go back and then you land on your hands. As you're going back, the instinct, right, is to protect your head. But what does that mean when you're upside down? It's to lift up your hands, right, and protect your head. And I, you know, in retreat, I had a nice hit on my head with a drop back. You know, and it hurt a lot. And but, you know, it's because you have to go against that counterintuitive thing. Like, the intuitive thing is to, like, oh, I'm falling, you know, and you quickly lift up your hands and then you smack your head. So you have it's a training in counterintuitive. And it's the same with, I believe, with entering the interior life. It's a training against the counterintuitive. Yeah, please do.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah.
Is that not
it's totally what I meant. And it's a great question. And for me, it's a very subtle balance because you're not talking about like dwelling, but just getting in touch with. One way they talk about it in Buddhism is renunciation. What would renunciation be? Especially those of you that are more Buddhist inclined. What do you think of when I say renunciation?
Be non-attached.
Non-attached. Yeah.
Yeah. Just understanding that you can't be truly happy in this world.
Yeah, well, that's a classical Buddhist understanding, is the belief that you can't be truly happy in this world. And that's what the Buddha taught. And it's a little counterintuitive to our New Age culture, where there's all these books on how to have the perfect partnership or, you know, how to find happiness. From a really baseline Buddhist perspective, those are all a complete farce. There is no such thing as lasting happiness. Every single friend you have, you're going to lose. I mean, it doesn't take much to realize that there's a great farce to that idea. Like, oh, if only I can get lasting happiness. You know, you're gonna lose everything. You're gonna lose your health. You're gonna lose the people you love. You're gonna lose your wealth. We are all on the Titanic here, you know, and we don't necessarily want to look at that. And a lot of what you see with things like New Age books is all about how to rearrange the deck furniture on the Titanic, as as somebody said, who I forget now. And it's, you know, it's true. We're so obsessed with like, no, you know, if only we just do this and this and this, then our lives will be just lined up, all the ducks in line, you know, and everything will be good. And meanwhile, you know, the horns are blowing and the ship is sinking. And there's a certain reality that's quite true about that. We are all in a catastrophe situation. We're all going down. And when I have touched on that in retreat in a really deep way, it's incredibly affirming in a really beautiful way. It's not like a wallowing. It's realizing that a kind of brother and sisterhood, and it increases a sense of love. And that's what I mean by counterintuitive. When you can get in touch with the catastrophe of our situations, that we are all dying. And, you know, there's a thing in the Mahabharata where one being comes up and asks a saint, and he says, what's the most amazing, wondrous thing in the world? And the saint says, the most amazing, wondrous thing in the world is that we're all dying and none of us really know it. And there's a deep, deep profundity to that when you really think of it, because all of us in the room share a similar defect in our hardware. And that defect is that we all can intellectually completely understand we're dying, but unless there's some of us in this room who have had a very close experience with death, we have a defect where we don't really know we're dying. And that sounds odd, but it's true, and you can explore it for yourself, that there's just some kind of defect in the mind that we all share. It's a human quality that we don't really quite understand, that we are actually only here for a very short amount of time. And those of you that have been around death a lot, that defect starts to fix itself. But so when I say feel the catastrophe, what I mean is to tune into that. Tune into the fact that we are in an active state of losing everything. And that's the counterintuitive thing, is that, like, that just sounds depressing. Like, why would I, you know, so you're saying, like, feel the joy and then tune into the catastrophe, you know? It sounds counterintuitive. But you can get to this sweet spot where you tune into that and it becomes uplifting. Not maybe uplifting, but it comes relieving. There's a relief in finally admitting to some of these things.
Because you don't have to control it anymore.
Yeah, and you can't control it, so you don't have
right,
to.
Right, you don't
yeah,
have to.
You don't have to uphold the illusion of control. There's a surrender that happens when you feel the catastrophe.
Is that easier to accept things when bad things happen than
you
know, suffering?
I don't know.
People that come.
The word easier is tricky, because for me, it's the feeling of it is deeper. The grieving is deeper. So I don't think necessarily easier, but it's deeper. And that deepness contributes to a kind of peace that you can't get by trying to avoid it. Yeah.
I was diagnosed with a fatal illness
yeah.
about 4 months ago, and I thought I would feel some kind of joyous, like, I'm going to savor every moment. And I thought it would, what it does for me is it makes that intuitive thing you just spoke about even stronger. Like, the denial is even stronger that it's happening. And I'm only reminded when I go to the doctor, like,
yeah.
Oh, wait a second, this shit's real.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like it takes... Like, it makes it so much stronger. And every once in a while, you get that window of, like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's... But I've talked to people who are in similar situations with me, and they pop out of bed every morning, and they're like, woo, happy to be alive. And I'm like, not there yet, you know?
Yeah.
So it's bizarre, because it kicks in so strong. It's like this big, fat, denial steroid thing.
Yeah, it's in our hardware so deep,
yeah.
You know? Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's amazing how profound it is, and I've heard it come from so many people in similar situations, and I've heard it from people who were in really nasty plane crashes and stuff, and like just suddenly you realize, wow, I was not even aware of how deep that denial goes. This is a story I've said before, and some of you have heard it, and I'll just say it real quickly because it relates to this a little bit. I was confronting a man. I was working for the state, and I had to confront a man with child molestation. And the moment that I confronted him with it, I mean, you know, basically he was going to go to jail. What I saw in him was this moment of relief. And it was such an unexpected experience. And it was because he was finally able to admit the catastrophe of his life. You know, he's finally, like, the weight of having to pretend that there was a normalcy in his life, you know, was lifted. And it was such an unexpected response to that. And so when I say feel the catastrophe, I'm really saying trying to tune into that state of feeling things deeply enough where there's almost a kind of relief and like, oh yeah, I'm in it. And I don't think it translates into like a happy-go-lucky, I'm going to savor every moment, but it oftentimes does translate into a tenderness towards people around you. And that's a much more valuable experience than feeling happy-go-lucky. Because to be tender towards people around you is a richness that is just, you know, invaluable, that tenderness. So then the third one I wanted to cover and we'll end for the day is regular practice. To cultivate an interior life, it has to be daily. It doesn't have to be long, but it has to be daily. And I really realized this with yoga. You know, I was talking with Lisa Shrempji one time, and she was saying, she's like, you know, remember those first moments of yoga when you just had all those pleasurable feelings rushing through your body? And I'm like, Lisa, I've been practicing yoga for, you know, over a decade. I've never experienced that. You know? I've never had like chronic rushes of joy flooding through my body. You know, it's been a drag since day one. And before 3-year retreat, I didn't have a daily practice. I had like maybe a 3-day-a-week practice. You know, and in retreat, you know, you really can't talk yourself out of it. You're not like, well, I would, but I'm really busy today.
Injured insects.
So what Annie and I both did is we did Iyengar. Iyengar has a 5-year series in the back of one of his books, and I thought it'd be a great thing to do in retreat because, you know, we had 3 years, and it's nice because you go through all the poses and you go in a gradual way where you build up certain strength and it also depletes the whole thing of willpower. So, you know, I was just like, oh, I'm just doing the practice. And so, you know, as I practiced every day, something very drastic happened in my own mind around yoga and in my body. And I realized there was a beauty that I had never accessed before. And I could have been practicing yoga for 40 years and have never accessed that if it was just once or twice or 3 times a week. So there's a kind of pleasure that's waiting for you, you know. It's yours for the taking. And the narrow gate to get there is through the jackass stubbornness of the daily practice. And that has to be, that just has to be a kind of, just a kind of toughness, you know, because there's plenty of days where you're not going to want to do it. And for me, the toughness is just you have to be thirsty as hell for deep pleasure. You know, Sri Nisargadatta, a great Hindu master, he said, the problem with you is not that you desire, but that you desire so little. And to me, that's really the essence of a real interior life, is you need to amp up your desire. Because every time you go into dullness, every time you go into denial, your desire also diminishes. You see people that who smoke a lot of pot or who, you know, drink a lot, they're not real. They don't have in general, at least I can say that was the case for me, is my desire just kind of diminished, you know? I was happy with kind of a certain level of mediocrity. And I think a lot of us in retreat, what happened for us is our desire became immense because we tasted the banquet. So to say, we tasted what was waiting for us. And now I think part of the problem with reentry is that there's now this separation between what we've tasted and where we are now. And so hopefully that the intensity of that gap will slowly bring us back into a little more of an interior life within the world. And I think it has to probably happen that way, is to go from such an intense experience into such a communal experience, there's going to be a little foom. And I saw it happen with virtually every retreater. And now I think we're all trying to figure out how to find our way back there, but in a way that's integrated with human beings and with other beings. And so regular practice, right? Sattu dirga kala nayantarya sakara asadito dirda bhumahi. What's that? Who knows? It's Patanjali, right? Mm-hmm. So your practice has to be steady. It has to be without gaps, meaning every day. And then it has to be done with devotion, with a certain integrity. And I'll say that for years my meditation practice was half-assed. I would do it, you know, but I would just allow my mind to stay in a certain state of dullness. And a friend of mine says it's like I'm getting a dog to drop a ball. Sometimes you have to be firm, drop the ball, you know? And I would, you know, it's, again, because what we're talking about is it's pleasurable to be dull. It's pleasurable to just sit there and kind of space out, or to be, you know, kind of on the breath, or to be kind of, you know, doing some kind of practice. But I would have to come in and just sometimes be like, damn it, Will, drop the ball, you know? Drop the daydream. And rip myself away from some kind of pleasant dullness or pleasant daydream, and really dedicate the time to training the mind to stay on the object. And that's what we're talking about with meditation. We're talking about training the mind to stay on an object. And it'll float off and it'll come back. And that's what it's that simple. You're simply doing the training. And then when you can get there, it's so pleasurable, right? And the more you taste that pleasure, the more you want to get back there. But in the meantime, you have to just have this jackass stubbornness, drop the ball, drop the ball. And a way to do that is, before you sit down, have a certain level of devotion. And when Patanjali says devotion, that's how I'm interpreting it, is like an integrity to the practice. I'm going to do this 100% full on. And if it's for 3 minutes, that's fine, you know. For 3 minutes, I'm going to be completely full on. Reggie Ray, who's a teacher, you know, he has a beautiful preliminary to meditation. He'll say, just kind of sit there and space out, you know, get ground yourself, and then be 100% present for the next breath that comes up. So you really, I mean, you know, and you really stay with it for that full breath. I notice when I do a short yoga practice, sometimes I go deeper because I know I have less time to practice. Like this morning, I just did a quick 40-minute practice, you know, and I'm like, I got to really go fully into a warrior two, you know? Whereas if I was doing an hour and 45-minute practice, I'd be like, oh man, I still got like an hour and 20 minutes. This is going to be totally half-assed, you know? And so it's the same thing with meditation. You really, before you sit down, you dedicate, all right, I'm going to do this. And maybe if it's necessary, then make it a shorter practice. Totally fine. Much better to be in it 100%. Much better to have 3 minutes fully present than an hour of just spacing out. And then you just slowly develop that 3 minutes into 4 minutes, into 5 minutes, into a half hour, you know, like that. But watch your mind next time you sit down to meditate and see how much you're behind it, like how much you're really dropping, you know, the daydreams, and how much you're allowing yourself to daydream. So really regular practice. And, you know, how many of us brush our teeth every day? Probably most of us, right? I mean, I won't say, okay, who doesn't? But when we were kids, we hated brushing our teeth. And those of you that have kids know, we just had a little 5-year-old with us. And, you know, it was like, I mean, it was as if we asked her to, like, go clean the whole house. We're like, Bella, brush your teeth. And she's like, you know, and finally, we had my stepdad, in his wisdom, he's like, oh, that sounds great, I'm going to brush my teeth too. And she's like, oh, well, I'll do it too if you're doing it, you know. But slowly over time, as we get into a habit of something, now, like, it would seem very bizarre to not practice in the morning. It would seem like uncomfortable to not meditate and do yoga in the morning. I'm about to leave tomorrow morning for overseas, and I'm like, worried about, like, oh God, how am I going to get that in? In the same way that you might worry, like, where am I going to brush my teeth if you were on the road or something, you know? So developing a regular practice, you just got to get through the resistance. And again, you may need to make the time less, or you work it to figure out whatever your particular situation is. And I think that's all I have to say today. And it's right about 3 o'clock, so I won't keep you much longer. I want to give a couple announcements, and then I'm just going to be hanging out here. If anybody has anything they want to say or talk about, I think Annie made vegan cookies, so Annie's got cookies. Anne's giving a workshop. What's the date on that?
May 18th
at the Three Jewels. What time?
1 to 4.
And it'll be on the Three Jewels website at 1 to 4 on May 18th. She's going to talk more specifically about an actual practice you could do every day. So she's going to talk about, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong.
We'll actually do a practice. We'll actually do a yoga asana practice and some short meditations and that sort.
So if you wanted like something that you could actually incorporate in your life, it's a short little asana series that you could do it every day. We're not in crazy absurd asanas, and then a short little meditation. She's going to give a couple different advices on practice. And then also, I found Annie is really wonderful for troubleshooting your practice. So if you're practicing and you're having specific problems, or if you're having some kind of blocks or something, she's a wonderful person to talk to about that. So you might want to just try to catch that and talk to her about some stuff about that. So that will be happening. And the last announcement I wanted to give was that there's a beautiful thing happening in our world right now. The world is getting crazy. You know, I was thinking like I would come out and, you know, like all war would be stopped and like everyone would be holding hands and, you know. And my father, in his kindness, kept a 3-year journal for me, and he sent it in, you know, he said right at the end of retreat. And it was like, you know, it was really intense, because you all, as tragedies have happened in the world, you've had time to process it. And it started hitting me all at once, you know. I had to stop reading it because the trauma was so intense. Like, some, you know, very difficult things have happened in the world over 3 years. And then personally, some difficult things have happened. You know, I've lost a lot of friends, and, you know, time is quick, and our time here is very short. And so there's that aspect of it. And right alongside with that, there's what I have felt like, you know, my mother sent me a Rolling Stones article on the Pope. And, you know, the new Pope, Pope Francis is his name, I think, right? And there's some beautiful, like, that's a new kind of, those of you that know about him, he's a new kind of Pope that's rather exciting. And he seems like a deeply beautiful, spiritual human being. And there's along those lines, there's a movement that's been happening for about 10 years or a little longer called the New Monasticism. And there's a new monastic movement that's kind of sweeping over the West, and particularly the United States, as people are feeling the courage to delve a little more deeper into their interior life. And there's interesting urban monasteries popping up, which are utilizing the discarded remnants of the empire, the American empire, places like Detroit and like North Philly and stuff like that, with abandoned houses and things. There's people going in and starting monastic spiritual communities that are reforming how we think about monasticism. For example, allowing partners to come in together and things like that, and having kind of like a community, more community outreach and stuff like that. I've started to become more aware of this, and there's a, you can really feel a movement towards people really wanting the interior life. And some of us have been very drawn for many, many years now to get in on that and to help increase that. And so we're looking at starting a small kind of like a hard-ass monastic community that would be open to people who want to basically get their asses kicked for a week or a month or 3 months or something like that. So what we're doing now is we're trying to get non-for-profit status. Then we're going to start looking for land. one of the aspects of retreat is we were totally off the grid, and which also meant that we did all our own, we composted all our own feces. And that was an amazing, completely bewildering experience to go from really disgusting pile of feces to the most beautiful loam, that loamous soil that you wouldn't hesitate at all reaching in and grabbing, you know. It's like, and I didn't know that you could do that. And we've had it, you know, tested, and it's 100% pathogen-free, beautiful soil. We've done some experiments where we grew kale in properly composted humanure, they call it, and then in Home Depot soil, the kale and the humanure, the leaves were like this. And in the Home Depot, the same amount of time, there are these little seedlings. And it was wild, you know. And as you become aware of the catastrophe, you realize 30 million people in the world don't have access to clean drinking water. And we're defecating in perfectly clean drinking water. And I'm not pooping in my yard now, I'm pooping in the toilet, right? Because it's more convenient, and it's a pain in the ass to poop in the yard and in the composter. But the system can't hold on that much longer. Things are going to change eventually. We don't know when, you know. And so we're interested in being in the forefront of that and showing a very human way of living in the world, spiritually, ecologically. I've spent a lot of time in monasteries. When I was 18, I wanted to be a monk, so I just hitchhiked around and went to different monasteries. And most of the old monasteries are very behind the times ecologically. I was in Kentucky, and we would, you know, use massive amounts of pesticides and things like that. The diet was horrible. I mean, I was literally living off of cheese and fruitcake. In one of the Trappist monasteries I was at, and beer, cheese, fruitcake, and beer. And I was dreaming about fresh vegetables, you know, at night and stuff. And so the new monasticism, part of that movement that's happening is people are looking at the whole body, the whole system, how the individual's person's interior life also relates to the environment around them, also relates to diet, all those things like that. So it's a very exciting, it's a very beautiful, amazing thing that's happening now. And when you look about the history of monasticism, you see it does go like this. There are dips in periods like in the first part of the in the early Christian church, there was that time with the desert fathers and the desert mothers in the Egyptian deserts, where it was very popular. And when we say desert fathers and desert mothers, there's this idea of like these old, you know, crusty men and women like in the desert. These were all 20 and 30 year olds, you know. And I started to realize that. And the stories that they tell are beautiful about people longing for an interior life, a deep interior life. So if anybody has any interest at all in hearing more about that, being on a mailing list of what we're doing, and especially if anybody has any interest in jumping on the bandwagon with us. We need a lot of help right now in terms of trying to get not-for-profit so we can start to get some donations and look at a piece of land. We're looking at starting a very humble, small community that would allow for people to come in and do experiments. And we're very interested in the interplay of yoga and monasticism. Because things can happen in your yoga practice when you go into deep withdrawal that can't happen in studios and things like that. So we would like to create a space where you can propose and say, I would like to see what really happens if I go deeply into this pranayama for 1 month. We'll feed you, we'll teach you how to empty your poop bucket and things like that, and we'll give you a space to do that practice, and we'll give you a buffer of solitude. And then at the end of your practice, you give a small talk to us on what you learned, and that talk would be in the file for other people to then learn from that. The whole thing would be free. It would be free to join it. It would be free to do you'd propose an experiment. We would accept that, or, you know, say, oh, maybe could you change it a little bit, this or that. So that's a little bit about, I just want to say a little bit about what a few of us are thinking of, and we just need people that also are drawn to that right now to join with us, because it'll take a small, you know, a small tribe to get it going. And we don't know where it'll be. I mean, it might be outside of Tucson, it might be in Kansas. It'll depend a little bit on where land shows up and different things. But so please come talk to me if you have any interest in that. And basically, if you want to get on the mailing list for that, I will just simply update you as we talk to architects and talk about building designs and just keep you informed on what we're doing and where we're looking in that whole thing. And it's so it's 3:15. Sorry to go over a little late. We'll end now, and if I'm here, so if anybody has any questions or they want to talk about anything. And thank you so much for coming. It's a really extraordinary honor for me. This would have been a dream to me, you know, like a year ago, like to be in a room full of human beings. It just is so miraculous, and I've lost it a little bit. Not that it's not miraculous, but I've lost a little bit of that preciousness, but I have enough left over where I can feel the absolute specialness of this moment, of just being together. So thank you. It's a beautiful honor for me, for you to let me speak and share a little bit.